Welcome to Reconsider. I'm Bill Hartman. This is the podcast to challenge you to ask better questions, to look beyond traditional models of thinking and arrive at better health and fitness solutions.
This is a continuation of, so if anyone's stumbling upon this episode and they're wanting to know about the foot, we just did an episode about how normal foot behavior and through early, middle, and late propulsion happens. It was a good chunk of time. So go back and watch that first. This is the follow-up to that. Bill wanted to talk about performance a little bit more, and I kept reeling him in.
That is your job.
Now I'm going to allow him to kind of run with the performance foot.
I know. Oh, that was funny. Was that a pun?
Yeah, I do it unintentionally sometimes. It's, now that I'm a father, it just kind of happens.
I gotcha. So we're going to run with the performance foot.
We're going to run with the performance foot. So we had talked about normal circumstances, what we want to see from the foot. We had talked about how shoes can help promote different phases of propulsion.
Right.
I think what you were trying to get at was what a performance adapted foot might look like and how that might not be what a podiatrist wants to see or what a physical therapist wants to see.
Right.
And people don't expect it to, because they think that like high functioning athletes should have like, you know, nice splayed toes and relaxed like arches that can mold and adapt. And that's not the case. So I'll let you go with that.
No, we have to consider circumstances and adaptations. So let me use a sprinter as an example first. And I'm not going to talk about the foot. I'm going to talk about pelvis orientation. You will be hard pressed to find a high level sprinter that does not have an anteriorly oriented pelvis. Reason being, if they have too much relative motion, number one, it dampens and dissipates the energy transfer that they need to press into the ground. So sprinting is an incredibly, we're going to talk about sprinting coming up in a webinar. But sprinting requires an extremely high force into the ground and on almost a vertical in less than a blink of an eye. Okay. Just to give you a timing. And so to do that, it behooves them to have an anteriorly oriented pelvis because it allows them to push down into the ground very quickly. So they have to do it in such a short period of time that you can't do it with relative motions. It's too slow. So what they do through training and all other aspects of like physical structure that can contribute to this, they create this anti-orientation. Okay, so we have this bias towards internal orientation, but it's not relative motions. And so when we look at a very high performance foot, we have to take the exact same things into consideration. Okay, hard lesson learned. I'm looking at a pair of feet, and this kid happens to be a Division I running back. In fact, he played at two different Division I football programs because everybody wanted him. And so he went to one. And then was happier at the second one. Regardless, had an injury. It was residual stuff was hanging around. They couldn't shake it off. They send him to me. We do a good job bringing him back. But he taught me a lot about feet, because I'm looking at his feet, and I had this first inclination too. It's like, oh, this is going to be a terrible looking foot. And then you find out that he runs a sub 4.4 40, and it's like, okay, something's going on here. What's the lesson that I can learn? And the thing that you have to recognize, if we consider the overall representation and the adaptations that are required to apply force into the ground over the shortest period of time, I have to have a foot that is positioned, oriented, and adapted to do the exact same thing. And so if I have a really high arch, so think about this. When I apply the highest forces into the ground, the foot would be in what many would call it a traditionally pronated position. So it has a lot of IR, so from rear foot to midfoot. But in this case, that's too slow. It would actually slow them down, right? They need instantaneous high levels of force production into the ground, which means I have the foot that is already very close to that position. So when we talk about about max P, max propulsion, where we have this initial release of energy. I have to land in a foot that is like right there, just in front of that point, because I still have to absorb energy and release energy. But I have to do it in less than the blink of an eye, which means that the foot has to be oriented and shaped appropriately for that circumstance. And so we don't want these what would be considered pretty feet, right? We don't want this perfect arch or anything like that. We're going to see a lot of feet that have this IR, compensatory strategy adaptation in the foot. Because again, they have to store and release energy in connective tissues. And we're not just talking about things like plantar fascia and Achilles tendon. We're talking about the bony representations too. So bones are very stiff. And so for every measure of deformation in those bones, they're going to release a lot of energy too. And so this just becomes a representation that has to be managed just like everything else. So, if we're looking at athletes that are anteriorly oriented, but we know, like, again, sprinter, jumpers, court athletes, a lot of your field athletes, lots of changes of direction. They have to cover, they might run 20 meters, right? And they'll approach top speed, but a lot of times, like, they're just changing direction at these really, really high rates. Or like a sprinter, they're going to put these really high forces into the ground very quickly. We're going to have an adapted foot to do that. And so one of the big mistakes, I think, is trying to fit that foot into some ideal representation that we would consider with an early, middle, and a late representation. They will still go through those phases, by the way, and actually a pretty good looking representation. But because it happens so quickly, you're going to see, especially like when they're really applying the forces into the ground, where you see that transition where they're really close to dead center middle, about ready to go to max P, you're going to see the typical representation of what their foot might look like when they're walking around. It's very counterintuitive, right? But it still has to be managed, because left to their own devices, they will keep smashing that foot into the ground. And then you will get other compensations that will be superimposed on that compensation that might lead to something else. And we talked about this when we were talking about the foot before, about putting people in different types of shoes, how it doesn't really influence the foot behavior nearly as much as what's happening more proximally, where we're seeing the differences in muscle orientation, differences in positions as they go through these phases of propulsion.
Right. So let's talk a bit about, so could we term it something like the performance foot is one that is adapted to be closer to max P?
In a lot of cases, yes, but I would hesitate, right. but we have to say that with a bit of, yes, because the minute you say that, then everybody's going to say, well, so-and-so doesn't have that foot.
Bill
and
said he's, the performance
And he's foot. Great at, yeah. No, yeah, it's yeah, like, yeah. We always have a multifactorial representation, but the again, the more things that we understand, the more things that we can recognize, the more we can say, oh, this might be why somebody has more of an arch in their foot, yet they are still a high performer. But I would hazard to guess that the closer you get to the pinnacle of every type of sports, like all of your high jumpers are going to have similarities to some degree, like high jumpers, pole vaulters, swimmers, sprinters, right? I mean, there is prototypical structures that tend to be the representation. There's a lot of similarities, certainly some individual differences. You know, you talk about, like, Usain Bolt was an outlier in structure because of his height. But I would say that he worked that to a tremendous advantage when you talk about, like, how he executes the, like, 100 meters compared to everybody else.
Because he's got the foot you're talking about. He has the feet you're talking about, too. Like, he has a very good example of IR close to max P foot. And people look at his feet and they go, well, I wouldn't think that someone that's that athletic would have such a flat foot.
Right.
It's like, well, that actually is to his benefit.
In this circumstance, yes. You know, but if he was to play, you know, I think I understand that he was a pretty good soccer player as well.
I think he tried to play cricket. I think he was trying to be a high performer in cricket because his brother is, and he never could cut it, which makes sense. He's good at straight line stuff.
Yeah. So, I mean, again, so advantages, disadvantages, and things like that. But again, I would just caution people, like, don't be absolutist about it, but also recognize the fact that, that what you're looking at might be ideal for it. For that context, and so again, it's just broadening your understanding of what the possibilities are, what the influences may be, and then looking at it from like a contextual circumstance. Because again, it's like I don't know if I should bring this up, but you know, do you remember that there was a picture of like LeBron James walking on a
He's got like a club foot.
And everybody was talking about like, oh my God, it's like, all right. But I think the guy's pretty good at what he does. He's been pretty resilient, like all things considered, you know, he's pretty resilient. And he's got some stuff, right, that you wouldn't consider necessarily ideal, but from his perspective, he might be taking advantage of some of these things. Right.
Yeah. So,
you know, and just might have a you know, a durability element that some people just don't have, right?
I think
and so. You also have to take that kind of stuff into consideration.
We talked about this a bit before, but I believe that basketball is a really good example of a lot of players just play a lot of basketball. So they become very fit at the specific demands of their sport, and the aerobic system being very aerobically fit, having a high level of aerobic endurance, I think forgives a lot of movement sins.
Oh, absolutely.
If you want to call them that. Like,
well, okay. We've talked about that too.
Yeah.
Right. So if I can provide energy from an oxidative standpoint, then, you know, your motor recruitment is different. And that's going to influence your ability to access movements and positions that might give you a protective element from a health standpoint. So it's like we have to take all of those things into consideration, and especially when you have an athlete that we would consider the mixed type of a sport where, like, yes, there's a high aerobic component, but then there's also a lot of short-term energy system. There's a lot of explosive movements. So there's a lot of repeat sprint type things, right? All of those things come into play, but from a foundational standpoint, from an energetic standpoint, it's like you can supply energy in an efficient manner. It's like it saves you a world of limitation.
I think there's a lot, and I think there's a lot of coherence to oxygen kinetics and the relative motion of oxygen in your body and the relative motion of joints. Like, it's all the same type of thing. Like how you can absorb and produce O2 delivery utilization. Right. It's like,
it's a gradient, right?
Yeah. Yeah. It's one of the gradients the almighty gradients that exist to help us stay alive. Heat transfer.
So it kind of,
so that okay. So we'll try to get back on track with the foot stuff here. So we're talking about adapted feet that don't seem to make intuitive sense when we look at them. When we're expecting this foot that moves well from early to mid to late, and I get this type of supination to pronation wave, nice back and forth motion, and I don't see that. Yeah. What I've done is the athlete has adapted in some way. They've created bony bends. They've created structural adaptations that allow them to be closer to the thing that gives them the ability to be great at that sport. Right. So like in the sprinting example, anterior orientation, getting stuck into this IR representation of a foot allows you to be closer to max P so that you can hit that point under the center of mass to keep you propelling forward with a high vertical hip displacement, all of these things that make you a good sprinter. But there could be secondary consequences to that just from a health and movement perspective. Your back might hurt all the time because there is no distributed load through the system. There's going to be a lot of focal tension at certain points in your body, but that's the that's the cost that you have to pay.
Right. Well, that's why we differentiate between health and performance.
Sure.
As far as the continuum is concerned.
Yeah. Right? Plug the network. Hey, if you're watching, if you watch some of these episodes and you don't know that, like, Bill and I created this thing called the UHP Network, and we don't really advertise very well. It's in the comments and whatever, but UHP.network,
yeah,
community of 1,600 plus, I believe, yeah, practitioners, coaches, clinicians, fitness enthusiasts, people trying to learn Bill's model. This is the place to get that information. This is the place to see. Bill just posted a great article in the free section. This is one of our free content weeks about going into and out of the cut. It's a very cool perspective that is sort of the basis for a lot of the movement stuff in the model. So go check that out, UHP.network. End of my promotional
point. That was pretty good. Like, you should have written that down.
Yeah. I mean, it's recorded and on a transcript, so I'll probably pull that if I want to. But anyways, there could be other, and what you had mentioned, like, there isn't one performance foot. I'm trying, and as you were saying that, I was trying to envision some other adaptations that you might see. And I was thinking in the track and field world, like, I might see a higher arch on, like, a thrower, someone that needs to do a bunch of flat turns and throw something with some stiffness. Maybe, like, if the orientation and just jamming someone away from midline to get this big flat turn going.
So we talk about that, though. So this is kind of cool to think about. Right. So if you're a spinner, so discus, or if you're a spinner with shot put
hammer.
Or hammer. Yeah. And I have thrown a hammer. And you think about, we talk about refrigerator turns all the time, because typically we're trying to avoid those in recapturing relative motions. But when we're talking about performance, we're talking about reducing the relative motion under that circumstance. So seeing an asymmetry in feet, should, you know, like, not be a primary concern in certain circumstances. So again, if I'm a spinner, if I disc, shot, hammer, it's like I'm spinning on one foot. And so the shape of that foot, so the amount of IR that you should see represented distally, so we're talking like towards the first metatarsal head, we would expect to see a much larger representation of IR in that position, which means proximally we're going to see a lot more ER. So we're not going to see a rear foot that's going to drop towards IR. We're not going to see the midfoot dropping towards IR. We're going to drop the IR more distally. And you'll see that represented, like I said, you'll see like an IR to ER differential in the first metatarsal. So don't be surprised by that. So and then that, if you don't see it on the other side, don't be surprised by that.
Right. And also, maybe don't, if they're a high performer, maybe don't try to fix it unless it's causing them to not live their life comfortably.
Well, the word that I will continue to use is manage it, like, yeah, recognize, yeah, manage it, and then collect data so that you understand when a change is taking place. And then you get to decide, okay, is this going to be like a more favorable adaptation? Is this a logical adaptation that, but you have to monitor these things, because again, it's like all they have to do is cross over too far in one direction. And now you got a situation that maybe you can't recover, because the adaptation is going to be a constraint change that you might need to hold on to for health.
Yeah. And what you had mentioned, having, like, you had talked about the differential from rear foot to forefoot. What that would look like is sort of a banana shaped foot with a bunion. Is that? Like,
that would be an extreme. That would be an extreme representation.
The most extreme representation.
Well, that would be the biggest IR. If you saw that, then that would be the biggest differential, right?
It's, yeah.
Like, and then left to its devices, it will continue because, again, like, a true bunion is going to be a constraint change.
Right, and that, yeah, the bunion is an attempt to put IR down 1,000%. Distally when the, yeah, proximal foot is very ER'd.
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Yes,
sir. That's our little bit of, instead of doing a whole episode on bunions, we, yeah, just hit it.
Well, so right there. You might, like, if we take the thrower's example, what you might see is the representation or the early formation of a bunion on one foot, and then you actually might see a forefoot on the other side that is, yeah, actually ER'd, because again, that's like, and especially with hammer. With hammer throws, and you when you watch the foot contacts as they're spinning, it does look like they're in opposition of the two positions. So don't be surprised. You might get like a think about this. You get like a Taylor's bunion on one foot, and then you get the one in the great toe on the other foot. Right. I mean, that's not unusual in that circumstance.
Okay. Yeah. So that would be an example of like a performance foot that it's not approaching, the foot shape is not approaching max P necessarily, but the bend in the foot provides them the ability to do their sport, perform their sport better.
Technically speaking, take the typical adaptations that would run through the foot and now cover them in that space.
Yeah, just move it up.
It just, yeah, because you're going to go through an early, middle, a max P, and a late. Like, it is inevitable. The question mark is how are you doing that, and which tissues are going to supply the representation? Because I can use an ER compensatory strategy. I can yield in a bone, and I have an early representation. It's like sure. That's the rules. When we talk about, we describe it with relative motions, but the rules are, it's like, okay, I need an ER representation with yielding connective tissue behavior, and that's my early. It's like, it doesn't have to be pretty. It just has to fulfill the requirements of the ability to absorb force in a specific representation, and that's what that would be.
Yeah, that's the T-shirt. Is your max P where it's supposed to be? That's the question I'm going to ask. Well, when you're watching an athlete who you're trying to address some type of movement issue, or they're complaining about, or they keep having to get surgeries, and you're watching them pitch, or you're watching them kick a soccer ball, you're watching them serve with their tennis racket. It's where in this athletic motion, where through early, middle, and late propulsion, is their max P where it needs to be, or are they trying to produce this max propulsion moment somewhere else?
Yeah.
And that's what's causing their issue to happen.
Yeah. So this is the biggest challenge. This is the biggest challenge of performance, because again, you take a physical structure that finds out that it can do something amazing. It's a superpower, but the way that they construct it is also destructive. It's like, take a baseball pitcher with chronic back issues. It's like, it may be that the strategy that they use to perform at the highest possible level is the only way that they can do that with that structure. And then they eventually just destroy it, you know, in the process. And it's like, you know, and you got to be willing to accept that fact too. We can't prevent, you know, some of these things from happening, because people want the performance end of things, right?
Yeah, it's like high performers that also have longevity are not as common. And you think about, like, you got the Nolan Ryans of the world who just they become these avatars of what proper mechanics are, which isn't fair, because those are the mechanics that this person just displays naturally, and it allows them to position the max propulsion where they would want it within their base of support. It allows them to not exceed their ability to distribute force, but also to produce very high levels of force where they need it, when they need it. So that's what makes them good. But that's more of a natural selection thing. That's not like, I can't necessarily train that. It's the long-term athletic discovery. It's not a long-term athletic development, which is something that you've told me about for years. It's not this, I can train my kid to be Nolan Ryan. He has to have those pieces available to let that sort of display as he progresses.
There's certainly elements that we can influence through training and adaptations, which would improve elements, but Nolan Ryan came up in 1969, I think.
I don't know.
He actually wasn't a great pitcher initially. I'm just thinking like the Mets. He was with the Mets when they in like the Miracle Mets.
Yeah,
and I don't think he was that great early on in his career. But
well, what do you think? What do you think helped change that?
Change what? That he got better?
Yeah, just experience. Like, he had more time to throw a lot of pitches.
Potentially, I don't know.
Yeah,
I don't know if anybody could pinpoint it. Right. But I do know, like, in the end, they go, people say, well, he worked out a lot, he exercised a lot. Okay. So generally speaking, like, he had a certain level of fitness, but, you know, I would hazard to guess it wasn't like a miracle exercise that he was doing that nobody else was doing. Right. It just took him maybe that long to adapt or become tactical, or, you know, there's so many elements there that are coming into play. But to his credit, you know, you look at longevity, and we could pull Tom Brady into that, you know, as somebody that, you know, just generally did a good job taking care of themselves, but chances are he had a little something that
of course. And then it's like, there's that. And he also had an offensive line that never let him get touched. That helps too.
You know? Yeah.
For the
most part. There's a lot of factors. Wow. We really went off the foot there, didn't we?
Yeah. We're talking about performance. What I want to say, like my Nolan Ryan example is such a significant one. And because I don't know if you've seen the documentary on Nolan Ryan called Fastball, where they kind of talk about he potentially was throwing 108 miles an hour, which is insane. And now they have people throwing like 105 regularly, and that's like a big deal. And I'm just thinking, like, Nolan Ryan was throwing absolute gas for years,
yeah.
And the old radar guns were just crappy.
It's
just wild to me. It's just like it's so like fluid in the way that he throws, and it's just like, I don't know. Makes me think about that as the example of longevity and performance. So, you know, it's about 25 minutes. That's about where we wanted to go. Did you pretty cover? Solid. Did we cover everything we wanted to talk about?
I think we got the general premise that everybody would understand. It's like, you know, just because you see something doesn't mean it needs to be fixed, although it would probably need to be managed.
Right. And then I guess, because we were talking about footwear, and we did talk about like what we would want to see out of a performance shoe, something that has a flat heel to toe drop, allows you to get into that IR representation and get that wave of IR from rear foot to forefoot. I don't know. It's like if you're, you know, sprinting cleats and sprinting track spikes, don't let your heel really hit the ground too much, so it shoves you farther forward a bit.
You know, the heel contact thing is variable. If you slow down even the world's greatest sprinters, like the amount of force that they're putting into the ground in such a short period of time is off the charts ridiculous.
Yeah.
And you know, in a perfect world, you could say, well, your heel shouldn't hit the ground because it probably contributes to a slowdown. Right, it's a braking force. It'd be more of a braking force.
It's too much on the absorption spectrum, and instead.
Okay, so this is the problem. This is the concern that you would have, right? Is that if I keep the heel off the ground, I maintain the connective tissue bias towards stiffness, which means that if I can deform the stiffer tissue, there's a greater release of energy, which allows me to obviously run faster because my step length would increase because I'll stay in the air longer. That's the goal, right? Yeah. And that's why they say you should not, you know, but like when we talk about reality and being human and doing this stuff as hard and as fast as you possibly can, it's like, it would be rare that you would see, you know, so Bolt took 41 steps in the 100 meters. And most people take like 44 to 45 steps, right? It's like, it was about a four step difference when he set the world record. And so, you know, in 40 some steps at maximum effort, right, give or take a few steps for acceleration and such, it's like, I would be hard pressed that you could do it perfectly.
Yeah.
You know, so you're going to tap, they're going to tap their heels, but you would not want to do that necessarily intentionally. It's just going to be a byproduct of the behaviors.
What I'm saying is that the shoe puts you in a position where that early, middle, late can happen much farther towards the forefoot, much more distally, and allow you to maintain that stiffness and that high vertical hip displacement that seems to be relevant to the success of sprinting, because it allows you to stay in that velocity.
That is the ER just outside of the most straight down force. So if you're just off of it,
the point right after max P.
Correct, because the heel would be off the ground under that circumstance, and then you would have the bias towards the stiffer connective tissues, and that's what we want to run fast, right? Yep. But this is also the reason why you can't sprint very long, because it is so energy inefficient from an energy production standpoint. It's like you just can't keep it up. It's just too hard.
Right.
And it's the amount of effort, the amount of muscular effort. So muscles tune connective tissues. Like that's what influences the stiffness. Now there's a certain amount of rate dependent stuff that connective tissues behave all by themselves, but muscles are working really hard to keep the connective tissue behavior at a very high level of stiffness almost entirely throughout. Right. There's going to be a release obviously during flight phase, but when you're on the ground, you want to be as stiff as you can possibly be.
Yeah. It's a very coordinated effort between stiffening and relaxation. Sure.
Yes.
The stiffening has to happen in an instant. It has to happen under your base of support very orthogonally. Otherwise, you get this sort of leak of energy.
It's a breaking. If it's too far in front, it's a breaking force. That's the big concern. It is in front of you. It's like your initial contact, your initial foot contact is in front of the center of gravity, but there's not a lot of downforce that's occurring until you're over top of the
direct.
Foot.
Yeah, I shouldn't say, because a lot of times I believe that coaching tries to promote this striking directly under you, and that will not work. It has to cycle through.
There has to be an energy absorption phase. It's just like I said,
it's going to be very far. It's going to be very. Yeah. It's not going to be very delayed.
Yeah, if you're fast, it's happening really fast. Like blink of an eye is 150 milliseconds average. That's average. Like a fast blink, like an intentionally fast blink could be like 100 milliseconds. And you're talking about like the world-class sprinters at top speed is 0.08. Right? Yeah. So they're doing it in half the time of the average blink of an eye.
Okay.
And they're cycling through like the whole phase of propulsion.
Yeah, athletics is interesting.
It's amazing.
Still coherent, but from a different perspective. It's happening a lot quicker. It's happening in maybe different places than where people expect. So it seems like it's not coherent, but it is completely.
Yeah.
Great. So if you're still watching this and you're frequent listener, watcher of the podcast, and over the course of this episode, you thought about a couple things that maybe you wished we got a little more into, go on the UHP network. There's a post where we're asking for people to post questions and ask questions that they want us to cover on the podcast. Go there, UHP.network, sign up, throw up some questions that you want us to talk about, topics that you want us to get into a little bit more, and we'll dig into those and maybe put it on an episode in the future. Let's say, okay, when you were growing up, Bill, did you have like a pizza shop that you would go to?
Yes.
Okay. Did that pizza shop have any video games in it, or are you too old? No.
Yeah.
So it didn't have
the bowling alley.
Didn't
we went to the bowling alley.
So what did they have? Did they have Ms. Pac-Man and pinball?
So I think one pinball machine, Pac-Man, Zaxxon, which was my favorite.
Okay. That was the question, by the way.
Centipede.
What was your favorite arcade, pizza shop, bowling alley video game?
But I rarely played. I rarely played, to be honest.
Like,
I was not
games.
I'm not a video game guy at all.
Yeah. I'm very much a video game guy. I will forever be a video game guy.
I would not. Yeah.
Yeah, I think I used to, every year I would go to like a putt-putt golf and games type of place, and that you could get unlimited tokens for like 3 hours. So that would be like my birthday party every year. It was just playing arcade games for 3 hours straight and eating pizza.
Yeah. When I was very young, the pool that we would go to in the summertime had a whole, like, I don't know, 15, 20 true pinball machines. So that was a big deal. I prefer
Those
that over a video game any day.
Well, yeah, it's a little more physical. And,
old. Yeah. It's old. It's like analog.
It makes you feel comfortable.
It didn't even have digital scoring. It had flip numbers on. That's to me seems like it takes a lot more mechanical brain power to create than it does.
That's
digital.
After you did your workout at the gymnasium and you got a steam and you used one of those belt vibrating devices to work your hips.
Absolutely.
Yeah, mine. Some of mine were like Chuck E. We used to go to Chuck E. Cheese when I was really little, and they had like they had this one like light gun game where these little ninjas would pop up and you'd shoot them. That was one. I can't even remember the name of it. There was a Michael Jackson Moonwalker game. It's like, yeah, in the 90s came out where it was just an awesome game that I remember playing a lot when I was little. Okay. All right. See you later, everybody.